Welcome, Republic Broadcasting listeners. Normally at this time, between 2 and 4 Central Time, there is the Tommy Crier Show, the Live Free Zone. Tommy today is away on a business trip, and he's asked me, Larry Beecraft, to sponsor and host his show today. And, of course, I did a radio program this morning between 9 and 10 on the same network, and I've got it again today between 2 and 4, and I invite everybody, sit down. If you're listening by satellite, if you're listening over the radio, if you're listening on the Internet, stay tuned because these next 2 hours are going to be extremely interesting. I have a very, very intelligent, brilliant in my mind, articulate, knowledgeable scholar, legal scholar, that's going to be my guest today. Everybody knows who he really is, but I think it's well worthwhile for me to kind of read off some of his credits. A lot of people that are in the freedom movement have watched a DVD that is also posted on the Internet, put out by Ed Griffin. It's called Fiat Empire, Why the Federal Reserve Violates the Constitution. My guest appears in that DVD. Also, he appears on Aaron Russo's DVD, America, Freedom to Fascism. I regret to report today that Aaron died yesterday. My guest holds 4 degrees from Harvard University. He's got an AB from Harvard College. He's gone to Harvard Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and he has a JD degree from Harvard Law School. He has briefed and argued a number of cases before the United States Supreme Court. They are Abood against Detroit Board of Education, Chicago Teachers Union against Hudson, and Communications Workers of America against Beck. The first time I ran across my guest was when he authored or participated in the drafting of, back in the early 80s, the Gold Commission Report. From the Gold Commission Report came this fantastic work. The first volume was Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution, but that book got revised into a two-volume, 1,700-page work that was published in the year 2002. He has also written a novel also dealing with the Federal Reserve called Crashmaker, and he has written the latest two works that he's authored is How to Dethrone the Imperial Judiciary and, most recently, Constitutional Homeland Security. Having listed these credits for my guest, let me introduce him. His name is Edwin Vieira. Are you here, Edwin?
Good to be with you.
Well, we're having a little bit of a network difficulties. Edwin's going to be coming on.
Larry?
Yes.
I'm here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I just listed off your credits. I don't know whether you were online. How are you doing today, Edwin?
Well, I'm ready to discuss a number of rather disquieting issues.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a mixed bag, as the expression goes.
Well, before you came on the air, I told our audience various things you've done in your life, where you graduated from school, the briefs you submitted to the Supreme Court, and the various books that you've written, Pieces of Eight, Crashmaker, How to Dethrone an Imperial Judiciary, Constitutional Homeland Security, the DVDs in which you've appeared.
Right.
But let's move on to, you know, let's move on from that point to get right to the crux of the matter. What do you see is going to be happening to our country monetarily, economically, over the next 3 to 4 years?
Well, we can already see in the financial markets, real estate markets and others, that we're coming into an era of financial and banking, or economic in the broadest sense, crises. And that's kind of an overblown word, crisis. I mean, but I think it applies to where we are. We're going to see more and more of those developing sequentially simply because the monetary and banking system is inherently unstable.
Okay, well, hold that thought. Well, we got a commercial break coming up. Listeners, we've got about another hour and 58 minutes of Edwin Vieira. Stay tuned.
Have you heard of a privacy crisis? Odds are you're already immersed in one. The U.S. government is now legally tapping phones, monitoring emails, tracking purchases, and seizing property in record numbers. Banks are demanding invasive personal information for even the smallest transaction. Unfortunately, stalkers looking to harm you or your financial situation are using the same methods. So how can you protect yourself, your loved ones, and all that you own? Well, the first step is to purchase the most important how-to book you'll ever read. It's called Privacy Crisis by author Grant Hall. In minutes, you'll know the methods he himself has used and advised others about in order to bank anonymously, open a safety deposit box without a social security number. With Privacy Crisis, you'll discover how to avoid judgments, seal your credit files airtight, drop off the radar, and virtually disappear from those looking to cause you injury. The ebook and hardcover versions are available at www.privacycrisis.com. Grant Hall's Privacy Crisis contains information and legal methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously, live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
The ideology powering the Democrats and Republicans is not liberalism or conservatism, but globalism. Globalists are concerned with what's good for big business and the American empire instead of what's fair for the American people. The only antidote to the poison of globalism is nationalism. Start reading the Nationalist Times each month. The Nationalist Times promotes a common sense, intelligent, and passionate alternative to the reigning party line. Published monthly since 1985, the Nationalist Times is a 20-page newspaper featuring outstanding writers and columnists who don't believe in taboos or sacred cows. Be one of the many thousands of loyal readers of the Nationalist Times. Subscribe now to the Nationalist Times. Just $19 for 1 year. That's 50% off the regular price. Send your $19 subscription to the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. That's the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. Or subscribe online at our website, www.anu.org.
Well, Republic Broadcasting listeners, we're back. My guest today is Edwin Vieira. This is Larry Beecraft. I am the substitute host for Tommy Crier, who is away from the airwaves today because he's got a meeting to go to. Right before the break, Edwin, we were on a very important topic. I asked you a simple little question. What does the future hold for this country? Let me kind of put a factual context to this. A couple of weeks ago, the Fed stepped in, and because there was rumblings in the markets, there's a crisis being created or developed because of the subprime mortgages. You know, the Fed had to jump into the scene. I guess it bought a bunch of these instruments, you know, all these defaulting loans. We've had a number of big brokerage houses announce that they're in trouble. We've had some money market funds that have closed their doors. People are being laid off. Some of these mortgage companies are going out of business. And then on top of that, I keep hearing all these little rumors from the conspiracy press, so to speak, that in the future we're going to have a new currency in this country called the Amero. What do you take of these events?
Well, I think it all goes hand in hand. As I was saying before the break, we're now facing these currency crises on the surface. There was always a currency crisis brewing below the surface. But now, like a volcano, it's erupted and we can actually see it. And these things will continue, and I believe they'll intensify because the system is inherently unstable. It's a debt-based money system. It's not tied to any particular commodity. It's not really controlled by the free market. It's politically manipulated. And that kind of a system generates irresponsibility on both sides, generates irresponsibility on the part of the lenders. They're willing to lend more because they make more the more they lend. And it generates irresponsibility on the part of borrowers. When they see easy terms, apparently easy terms for loans, take them, not being too concerned about whether they'll be able to continue to finance those transactions in the future. Now, many of those people are in foreclosure. They're out on the streets. They're out of jobs. So you see the consequences. The chickens do come home to roost. Now, what interests me about this is not so much these economic crises, because they're inevitable in this kind of a situation. But what's the consequence? Well, one of the consequences we're already seeing are developing social crises. People out of jobs, people out of their homes. Of course, we have other social crises that are also endemic that play into this as well. We have the invasion of illegal immigrants, number one. That's on the surface. We can see that. And then below the surface, we have perhaps a worse crisis, which is the maleducation through these public indoctrination centers, so-called public schools, of generation after generation of Americans, so they can't even think properly to face these problems. Now, out of economic crisis comes social crisis. Out of social crisis will come political crisis, because people are simply not going to live with the consequences of these economic and social problems. They're going to demand responses of some kind. Of course, if they're maleducated, they're going to demand, or they're going to accept the wrong consequences. And that brings us to the point that you mentioned just at the end of your introduction here, the North American Union, which I think is one of the responses, if you will, that the establishment in this country has to what they know is coming and that they know they can't avoid. They're trying to get a benefit out of it. Monetary system will have to change, and the question is, how do they maintain their position of power? And the answer is, well, if the roller coaster is going down, you ride the roller coaster as far as it goes. You certainly don't jump off. And their plan in this case, I think, is to give us a new currency as the instability of the Federal Reserve note becomes more and more acute, and we'll see that in hyperinflation, loss of purchasing power, loss of value in the Federal Reserve note. At some stage down the line, they will tell us, oh, we have this new, quote-unquote, stable currency, at least it will be stable relative to the Federal Reserve note at that point in time, called the Amero. Well, it might have some other name. The Amero is the name they're floating around now. And that is a currency for the entire hemispheric bloc made up of Mexico, the United States, and Canada. And you folks want to exchange your Federal Reserve notes for Ameros. Oh, and by the way, if you do this, then you'll also have to accept this new hemispheric structure called the North American Union. And that's the trick. That's the hook, if you will, in the system, that they'll get Americans to the point where they'll be so desperate that they will be willing to give up their national sovereignty for an illusion of temporary stability by exchanging their increasingly less valuable Federal Reserve notes for these new Ameros, or whatever they're called at the time. And the establishment will end up with maintenance of control over the financial system. Now they'll be controlling some banking establishment that generates the Amero instead of the Federal Reserve note, and they'll have this new hemispheric governmental structure, North American Union, whatever they're going to call the legislature or the bureaucracy in that structure, which will be another level removed from popular self-government. All right? It'll be like a super federal structure over the federal structure we already have now. And, of course, it will claim the power to enact legislation and to give out judicial decisions and to make administrative regulations that are superior to anything Congress can do under our Constitution, or obviously any of our states can do under their own legislation or their own constitutions. So the average American voter will be now, instead of two levels removed, you know, his state and then Congress, there'll be three levels removed, and who knows how they're going to choose the leadership elements, let alone the bureaucracies, in this North American Union. All one has to do is take a look at the relationship of many of those European countries to the European Union and the kind of dictatorial attitude that those European Union bureaucrats in Brussels maintain to get an idea of what it will be like here under the North American Union.
Okay, let me stop you right here. This system, this monetary system we have right now, is economically unstable. It's built upon fractional reserve banking, which is inherently, fractional reserve banking creates the banking cycle, when creates depressions. Because of the inherent instability of this system, and right now the operators of this system can foresee in the next 3 and 4 years that this system is most likely to implode. And as a consequence of that, they're running forth with their rescue program, and the rescue program is going to be far worse, and they're going to be in control of it. They're going to let this develop into a crisis, and they're going to step forward with a solution in the Hegelian dialectic type of approach. Mm-hmm. Is that the way it's coming about?
I think so. Now, let's go back a little bit in history. There's nothing new here. If you remember the National Currency Act, 1863,
yes.
And then there was another one, 1864, just the same thing, slightly amended, which created the national banking system. So that was really your first great cartelization of the monetary system in this country. There had been the U.S. banks before the Civil War, but those were just unitary institutions. This national banking system purported to bring all of these entities called the national banks into one big pyramidal structure. So you had that way back then, 1863, and that went on until 1913 with the Federal Reserve. Now, that was a system that didn't avoid crisis, because it was claimed that it would, but it didn't. They had a number of banking panics. The major one was in 1907, and it was used as the justification, rationalization, if you will, for the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System was put in for exactly that reason. We have an unstable system. We have to make it better. We're going to make it scientific. We'll end depressions, blah, blah, blah.
We would need an elastic currency.
Elastic currency, that's right. No sooner did they put it in, they had a depression in 1921, and then they had the big blowout in 29 through 32. All right, so it proved its worth in the first great test, and it failed. So we're going to see a rehash of that. Same type of situation. Monetary instability, the same people are going to come back and say, oh, we've got a better system for you, but now they have the added little twist that it's going to take our governmental structure from a national level to this supranational hemispheric level. Now, you say that they are aware of the coming crises. Sure they are. But they also understand something here, that these kinds of crises can get out of hand because the whole system is based upon confidence. It's a confidence, I like to say, it's a confidence game in two senses of that word. It's a confidence game in the sense of it's a swindle, and it's a confidence game in the sense of it depends upon people having confidence, people believing in the swindle. As soon as people start realizing that they're being swindled and they lose confidence, the confidence game no longer works, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, when that happens, you're going to have social and political consequences which the establishment will not like. And that's why they're setting up the Homeland Security Department the way they are. That's why they're paramilitarizing local and state police. That's why they're talking about, they've done it, John Warner Appropriations Act of 2007, allowing the president to use the National Guard throughout the country in terms of any kind of public disturbance that he thinks endangers public order. All of that is being set up not, I believe, because they're afraid of Muslim terrorists or any of that nonsense. It's because they expect to see, as you have more and more of these crises leading, I think, in the direction of hyperinflation, because that at least they think they can maneuver better than a depression, you're going to see social dislocations, you're going to see situations in which public order really does break down. And they want to be able to control that on the streets. And they're going to do that through the Homeland Security Departments and this paramilitarization of federal, state, and local police, National Guard, and so forth and so on. And then under those circumstances, assuming that they have control of the streets, assuming that, of course, they maintain control of Congress and the presidency and the Federal Reserve and that whole huge bureaucracy in Washington, then their next step will be, under those conditions in which people are screaming for help, they will lay on the table the North American Union and the Amero and probably some other provisions and say, see what we've done, we've saved you again. Just as we saved you in 1913 with the Federal Reserve System, we're saving you now with the Amero Bank or whatever they call it. And Americans, unfortunately, lots of them, because they've been miseducated by the indoctrination system, will say, great, we'll accept that because we'll at least have some jobs, we'll at least have some income, we'll have a semblance of stability, and that's better than chaos. And, of course, it will have been engineered chaos, and it will be an engineered stability. I mean, it's all a charade, but the average person, you know, he's going to grasp at whatever straw if he's sinking economically into the septic tank, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So that's their plan, and it's a plan they've used before.
This sounds like something that they've done over in Europe. Are there parallels between what they did in Europe and bringing about the euro and what they'll do here?
Well, I think they didn't have to go as far in the allowance for chaos.
Okay, well, Edwin, we got a commercial break coming up. Listeners, stay tuned. My guest today is Edwin Vieira. This will be a very interesting program.
Have you heard of a privacy crisis? Odds are you're already immersed in one. The U.S. government is now legally tapping phones, monitoring emails, tracking purchases, and seizing property in record numbers. Banks are demanding invasive personal information for even the smallest transaction. Unfortunately, stalkers looking to harm you or your financial situation are using the same methods. So how can you protect yourself, your loved ones, and all that you own? Well, the first step is to purchase the most important how-to book you'll ever read. It's called Privacy Crisis by author Grant Hall. In minutes, you'll know the methods he himself has used and advised others about in order to bank anonymously, open a safety deposit box without a social security number. With Privacy Crisis, you'll discover how to avoid judgments, seal your credit files airtight, drop off the radar, and virtually disappear from those looking to cause you injury. The ebook and hardcover versions are available at www.privacycrisis.com. Grant Hall's Privacy Crisis contains information and legal methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously, live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
Morning, neighbor.
Hey, shouldn't you be at work?
I am. As a matter of fact, I pulled another all-nighter.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, at least I'm making money 24/7, but I never have to go to work.
So what do you do?
Not very much at all now. About a month ago, I heard about this website. It's got a funny name. It's DidYouRobBillGates.com.
That is funny.
Yeah, you can earn $1,200 to $12,000 a week starting the very first week.
Oh, is that how you bought that new mower?
Yeah, and the motorcycle I've always wanted, too. You should log on. Find out how you can become financially free.
So what was that website?
It's www.DidYouRobBillGates.com.
Just wait, I'll go get a pen so I can write that down.
You don't need to write it down, it's easy to remember. DidYouRobBillGates.com.
Yeah, DidYouRobBillGates.com. That is easy.
It's easy, and the money is awesome.
Hi, this is Brother Michael Diamond from Most Holy Family Monastery. We are now offering a critically important $10 package. The package contains three DVDs with 10 different programs, our new 658-page book called The Truth About What Really Happened to the Catholic Church After Vatican II, which is the most comprehensive book ever produced on what has happened to the Catholic Church in the last 50 years. You also get another 335-page book and other material. Order now at our website, mostholyfamilymonastery.com. The last word monastery is spelled M-O-N-A-S-T-E-R-Y. At the website, you can watch all of our videos for free, read sample chapters of the new book and other articles, or call us 24 hours a day at 1-800-275-1126. That's 1-800-275-1126. Or you can mail in your order to us at Most Holy Family Monastery, 4425 Schneider Road, Fillmore, New York, 14735. The price of the whole package is $10, which includes media mail shipping, $15 for UPS Ground, or $30 outside the U.S. MostHolyFamilyMonastery.com.
Well, Republican listeners, we're back. My guest is Edwin Vieira. Edwin, let me ask you this simple question, but let me put it into context. Before the break, we were talking about trying to maybe reproduce the European Union and the Euro and do the same thing over here. We have kind of a fact pattern in the past that kind of lends credibility to that, because that's happened in our past. We had the Panic of 1907. As a result of that, we started studying European banking. And there's a whole lot of, in the serial set, you can see all these reports that were generated to build the Federal Reserve System. Mm-hmm. Then we had old Frank Vanderlip and Nelson Aldrich and others hop on the train and they go down to Jekyll Island and they plan all this out. And then they step forward with this legislation that on December the 23rd, 1913, while most of Congress is away for the Christmas holidays, Congress allegedly approves this act. And what happened there was that the banks came along and they became stockholders in each local Federal Reserve Bank. Could they do something like this, that the supranational bank that's going to issue the Amero, whatever its name might be, would first extend its feelers out into the American and Canadian and Mexican banking system and say, hey, look, after we go through this hyperinflationary period, your assets are going to be worth trash. And what you can do is you can convey to us in exchange for stock interest in your local bank. You can exchange your assets and convey them to this supranational bank, and therefore the regional banks that are created in the supranational banks will then acquire all these non-performing assets and give the local bank stock ownership in it, and then
Then you've got all the banks in all three countries are on the take and ready, willing, and able to support this new supranational bank that's going to issue the currency. Is that the way this is going to happen?
Well, it's certainly a very plausible scenario, and I would go one step further. I don't think they're going to need to, threaten these banks or, in a sense, cajole them into coming into it. I think the banks are all in line to do this.
Absolutely right.
This is to their advantage to do it. Now, they may present to us a different picture of how it's being done, but it's obviously when the Federal Reserve was created, all of those national banks that were out there and became the first member banks of the Federal Reserve were not fighting to stay out.
Yes.
They wanted to get in. It was, for their point of view, it was feeding at the trough. Now, in this particular case, obviously the banks will want to get into this because of the fear of increasing instability in the present system. Now, they have lots and lots of assets, but let's take a big commercial bank. Let's say it's holding a lot of mortgage paper. And that mortgage paper obviously now is worth a lot less than it was. Well, they could exchange it unit for unit with new Ameros, right, whatever that unit will be, A's. And now they're getting dollar for dollar on that mortgage paper. And they're getting a stable currency. And that's their entry into the system. You know how the Federal Reserve operates? The regional or the member banks come to the Federal Reserve with some asset, say a U.S. government bond, but it could be a mortgage package of mortgages. It could be farm produce, for that matter. And the Federal Reserve arranges with the Federal Board of Governors to generate actual currency, if they wanted currency, on the basis of that asset. So I imagine that's how the Amero system would work. These banks that from Canada, Mexico, and the United States that would become the new member banks of the Amero system would bring forth whatever assets they're holding, and those would be the basis on which Ameros would be generated. And now that would enable them to create a whole price structure in Ameros almost right from scratch. Which, of course, is the major problem in starting any new currency, is what are the prices going to be under that currency. The interesting question is, where is that Amero bank going to come from? You see, there's no North American legislature yet. There's talk among various administrative agencies like the U.S. Commerce Department and its equivalent in Mexico and Canada about these trade agreements. And that I understand to be the basis of building this system. First you get the trade organized, and then you put up a superstructure of legislation and judiciary and other administrative bodies. But right now that superstructure isn't there. So where is this America? That's the big question. What are they going to use as the basis for creating the Amero? Clearly the Federal Reserve can't create it.
Well, there's this possibility that the Federal Reserve could come along and do like what they're doing right now, as they hyperinflate, suck up all the assets of the banks that are non-performing, so it'll sit there and hold the subprimes and all these bad notes of all these banks. So the banks are sitting there flush with a whole bunch of Federal Reserve credit. Well, then let's, for purposes of discussion today, this supranational bank, let's use the an acronym, Mexico, M, U.S., U.S., C, Canada. Let's call it the Musk Bank.
Right.
The Musk Bank will somehow, some way, acquire all the assets of the Federal Reserve banks and step into its shoes, and then issue stock to the banks in addition to payments made to the bank of other assets. So it can just simply sit there and a credit system can suck up any type of assets it wants, extend credits to the bank for assets that are conveyed to it. So it could absorb all these non-performing assets and then just step forth immediately within the span of a month and say, hey, we got a whole monetary system ready to roll.
Oh, well, sure. And in fact, that the Musk Bank could conceivably be entirely a private bank made up of major American, Mexican, and Canadian banks.
So true. Folks, we've got another commercial break. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. because you can handle the truth.
The ideology powering the Democrats and Republicans is not liberalism or conservatism, but globalism. Globalists are concerned with what's good for big business and the American empire instead of what's fair for the American people. The only antidote to the poison of globalism is nationalism. Start reading the Nationalist Times each month. The Nationalist Times promotes a common sense, intelligent, and passionate alternative to the reigning party line. Published monthly since 1985, the Nationalist Times is a 20-page newspaper featuring outstanding writers and columnists who don't believe in taboos or sacred cows. Be one of the many thousands of loyal readers of the Nationalist Times. Subscribe now to the Nationalist Times. Just $19 for 1 year. That's 50% off the regular price. Send your $19 subscription to the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. That's the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. Or subscribe online at our website, www.anu.org. The ideology powering the Democrats and Republicans is not liberalism or conservatism, but globalism. Globalists are concerned with what's good for big business and the American empire instead of what's fair for the American people. The only antidote to the poison of globalism is nationalism. Start reading the Nationalist Times each month. The Nationalist Times promotes a common sense, intelligent, and passionate alternative to the reigning party line. Published monthly since 1985, the Nationalist Times is a 20-page newspaper featuring outstanding writers and columnists who don't believe in taboos or sacred cows. Be one of the many thousands of loyal readers of the Nationalist Times. Subscribe now to the Nationalist Times. Just $19 for 1 year. That's 50% off the regular price. Send your $19 subscription to the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. That's the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. Or subscribe online at our website, www.anu.org.
Oh, we're back, listeners. My guest today is Edwin Vieira. I just got notice from the board operator that we got a tremendous audience on today. And it's obvious because everybody wants to listen to you. So before the break, we were talking about how this Musk Bank,
right,
as an acronym, could be created. What will happen after they create the bank and we start operating on a new currency called the Amero?
Well, I think two important things here. Number one, it will perpetuate the financial power of the very people that we don't want to perpetuate financial power. And that's their goal. Obviously, in a crisis situation, the country can go in two directions. It can change its financial system, and it can remove from positions of political authority those individuals who have messed things up over the decades, if you will. Or we can continue with those people in control and give us some new structure that they are in charge of. So we don't really gain anything in the long run by the latter course of action, but that's certainly what will happen if we accept whatever this bank is, the Musk Bank, as we're calling it now. Secondly, we can be sure that to create that Musk Bank, large amounts of assets are going to have to be transferred into its control.
Right.
It can't generate currency based on nothing. I mean, even the Federal Reserve doesn't generate currency based on nothing. At worst, it takes a government bond, so it's being promised by the Treasury that at some stage taxes will be collected. There is something there in the long run. And then the question becomes, well, where will these assets come from? And one of the things that worries me is it possible that those assets may be essentially stolen from the American people? You can imagine all sorts of eminent domain theories or transfers of securitized mortgages and so forth and so on, in which this Musk Bank, the North American Union Bank, would end up with control of vast amounts of property within the United States as the basis for generating the euro, along the lines of what John Law did in France.
Absolutely.
Right? The famous John Law experiment, because he was using the swampland in Louisiana as the basis, and it failed. But that same principle could be applied again. And then you have the American people now subject even more than they are now, to control and domination and manipulation by the banking and financial community. So another very dangerous thing. And, of course, the third point is once you create something like the Federal Reserve that can finance the political activities of whatever the North American Union governmental structure will look like. You now give that structure independence from the people it's controlling. I mean, it's bad enough now that the federal government can go to the Federal Reserve and have the Federal Reserve monetize governmental debt, so-called hidden taxation through inflation. That's really a form of taxation without representation, because you're having future generations liable to pay the tax, and the money's being spent now. Imagine that race to the next level, where you have this hemispheric structure, this supranational structure, being able to do that for Canada, United States, and Mexico. American people are going to be even more subject to a form of taxation without representation than they are. So it really breaks down, even more than has already broken down, the whole concept of representative self-government, national sovereignty, federalism, subsidiarity, local control, all of those elements which are, to my way of thinking, the great characteristics and the reason for the success of our American system since the Constitution was put in. Those things have been under attack since the Wilson administration, obviously, since 1913. And now the people who have been in charge of the political process in this country since 1913 are telling us that they're going to give us the coup de grace, they're going to finish it off by taking it to the hemispheric level. And they're not going to stop there, Larry. Let's face it. Their structure is designed first to break the world, or to rearrange the world into three blocks: the European bloc, the North and South American bloc, because they will extend this North American union to a hemispheric union.
Then an Asian.
And then an Asian bloc. And then that's the trilateral structure. We know the Trilateral Commission being kind of the front group that has proposed that over the years. And then those three blocks will somehow be merged with a superstructure on top of them, and eventually that will be coalesced into one great
world government.
World government, global government. That's the plan. And it's obvious. You can go back and find this kind of literature laying out this picture probably before the League of Nations after World War I, but certainly during the World War II and immediately thereafter, that period, because they thought at that time the United Nations might be the vehicle for doing it. They discovered the United Nations really doesn't have the wherewithal to accomplish what they want, and so they have to take these other steps. But the basic plan is still there. So we're looking at really, and I wrote a column on News Reviews with this title, "Would the North American Union Be American Patriots' Last Stand?" We're really looking at a kind of last stand here, because if we lose our national sovereignty to the North American Union, barring some miraculous event, there's no turning back from that.
Wow, wow.
I don't think there is.
Okay, Evan, let's kind of shape the discussion in the rest of the program.
Sure.
Can we get into how this came to be? Let's get back into a little bit of the history of money and banking, and the growth of institutionalized banking in this country, and then after that, let's talk about some solutions.
Okay. Well, there'll be directions. I don't know whether they'll be solutions. They're directions.
Okay.
I think it came about primarily, if you will, at least initially, by accident. It came about driven by greed. And
well, first, hey, tell our listeners about fractional reserve banking.
Well, fractional reserve banking is really a form of sleight of hand. If you have what I would call an honest loan bank, what it does is collect deposits from depositors, and then it takes those deposits and lends them at interest to hopefully profit-making ventures. So it's paying a certain amount to its depositors for the use of their money, and then it's trying to loan out that money at a higher interest rate, and the difference between those two rates is how the bank makes its profit and stays in business. But you notice in that system, no new money is created. The only money that's lent is the money that the bank has received from its depositors. That's 100% reserve banking, if you will, or straight loan banking. Fractional reserve banking goes the next step, because the bankers discovered that if their depositors gave them money to be withdrawn on demand, that is, the banks promised to pay back that money anytime the depositors came in, most depositors did, in fact, come in and ask for their money to be withdrawn. So the banks discovered that they could loan out some of that money. So instead of having 100% of the funds
on deposit, they could only have 90% or 80% or whatever, depending upon the economic circumstances. Then they discovered that, lo and behold, they didn't even have to loan out the actual money that the depositors gave them. They could create some new bank currency of their own and loan that out. And that was the beginning of banks of issue. They would actually issue currency more than the amount of gold or silver, because gold or silver in those days was the actual money. Bank notes were simply promissory notes. They were promises of the bank to pay. And the banks discovered that those promissory notes would circulate, that they weren't brought back on a regular basis to be redeemed. And obviously it was to their interest economically to loan out more and more and more of those promises, because they were making interest on the deal. Now, the difficulty was, at some stage down the line, the free market recognizes that there actually is more of this paper floating around than is economically viable. Now some people start taking that paper back to the issuing banks and demanding payment in gold and silver, which the banks have promised to do. The banks suddenly discover, uh-oh, we don't have enough reserves. We can't pay this back. And we have two choices. Either we can go bankrupt, we can declare that our debts are greater than our assets, go out of business, maybe be sued for fraud, our directors and officers, or we can run to the government and ask for some kind of special privilege to protect us. And that's precisely how this whole interface, or incestuous relationship probably is a better term, between banks and government began.
That goes back to the time of William Patterson and the Bank of England.
Well, it had been developed even before then, actually. The goldsmiths had discovered this fractional reserve principle, and there were some other banks that had done this on a smaller scale. But the Bank of England became probably the paradigmatic structure of this kind. Now, we didn't have banks of that nature within the American colonies, because in the American colonies, the governments issued their paper money directly. They didn't have, there were banks, but they didn't have the kind of relationship we have with the Federal Reserve Bank.
Well, you're talking about the colonial
system. Colonial system, colonial paper money, bills of credit, they were called. Now, the Founding Fathers discovered something about bills of credit, which was that government treasuries aren't much more responsible than private banks, and they overissue. And the classic example was during the War of Independence, you had overissues of the Continental currency, which was issued by the Continental Congress. And you had overissues by the state treasuries, state bills of credit. So the Constitutional Convention comes along, and the framers said, no, we're going to end this. No state shall emit bills of credit, number one, that eliminates that, and we're not going to give a power to Congress to emit bills of credit. And until the Lincoln administration, during the Civil War, there were no issues of bills of credit by the states or by Congress. What did they do? They began turning to this other mechanism, which was the interface of private banks and government. The states created loads of private banks. Some of them were not really very private, because the directors and officers were controlled by the state legislatures, and all the capital came from the state legislatures. At the national level, you had two banks of the United States, the First Bank of the United States, Second Bank of the United States. Those weren't entirely, they were created by Congress, they weren't entirely controlled by the federal government. About 20% of their stockholders, or 20% of the stock was owned by
the United States,
and the rest was owned by private parties. So it was a cooperative venture between the national government and the private stockholders, and they were private banks. Now,
Let me stop you right there. This leads into something, a direction I wanted to go with in this radio program. Could you say that the officers of the First Bank of the United States or the Second Bank of the United States were officers of the federal government?
No, in fact, it was held by John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, in the Supreme Court's opinion of Osborne versus Bank of the United States, that they were not, notwithstanding that. So the Second Bank of the United States was the subject of that case. Under that particular statute, 20% of the directors of the Bank of the United States were appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. And in the Osborne case, Chief Justice John Marshall said, well, that didn't make any difference. They weren't officers of the United States. That just happened to be the mechanism by which the United States participated in this corporation. But it didn't make them officers of the United States. So those were completely private banks. Now, the second bank in the United States, of course, was the subject of the great fight with Andrew Jackson, who was a hard money man, and the bank's charter was not renewed. Eventually, it became a state bank in Pennsylvania and then failed. But that period from Jackson through the Civil War was a hard money period. In fact, we actually separated the U.S. Treasury from the private banking system. They had what was called the sub-treasury system, where the Treasury acted as its own depository for receipt and disbursement of funds. And there was no connection with private banks. Well, comes the Civil War. And actually, both sides in the Civil War, the Union and the Confederates, relied upon paper currency. But let's just take a look at the Union, because that was the one that survived. 1862, they created the first U.S. paper currency since the War of Independence, the so-called greenbacks. Legal tender, at that time, irredeemable paper money.
An idea coming from Samuel Chase, who ultimately became Chief Justice.
That's right. Samuel Chase was the man, the Secretary of Treasury. He pushed the thing through. And when he became Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court in the Hepburn versus Griswold
case. Yeah, he held his own act unconstitutional.
He held the act unconstitutional. He said, well, you know, it was a war measure, and we had to do it, but we were wrong, and it's unconstitutional. So, I mean, it tends to go to show you how the political pragmatism was controlling events in those days. But that was the first issue of paper currency. Now, at the same time, or closely to it, 1863, Congress also passed what was called the National Currency Act. And this was the beginning of the structure that eventually became the Federal Reserve, the close connection between the financial power structure, the private financial power structure, and the U.S. Treasury. And in fact, if you read the legislative history, it's explained that way. They say we need to do this because we want to have a close cooperation between private high finance and the U.S. Treasury. And this is how we're going to get it, by giving them these special privileges. And the special privileges were you could create a thing called a national bank, which is a private bank, and then you would take U.S. bonds that you would purchase in the market, take them to the Treasury, and they would give you 90% of the face value of those bonds in a thing called national currency notes, generated by the Treasury. And then you and your private bank could take those national currency notes and loan them at interest. So that was the relationship. The government was allowing you into this process by which you could make money, and you were helping the government by buying U.S. bonds as
so
security.
Can I stop right here and give a typical example, you know, a hypothetical example. Let's say that a national bank in Chicago had 1 million in U.S. bonds in 1867.
Right.
So it could take that $1 million in bonds to the Treasury and get $900,000 in currency.
Yeah, plus they would continue to get interest on those bonds.
Right. And then they would deposit that in they'd become till money that they could loan out.
Right. At a fractional reserve basis.
Yes, yes, yes. So then they would have $900,000 in reserves. And let's say that the multiplier here is 10. There was a 10% reserve requirement.
Right.
You know, from a practical viewpoint.
Right.
Well, they could then issue $9 million in loans.
Right. I think the multiplier was lower than that, but the point is still made. This was a good deal. Right. This was a good deal that came about through the enactment of a very special political privilege. Now, the problem with that system was that it depended upon government debt, right? For each $900,000 in currency, you needed to have $1 million in government debt. So there was a limitation, especially after the Civil War, when the attitude in the country was, we want to retire debt. We don't want to increase debt. So that system was inherently limited in its ability to expand. And they also had crises. It was still a fractional reserve system. There were a number of crises. As I said earlier, 1907 was a big one. And that caused pressure coming out of the financial community primarily for reform of the system. So Senator Aldrich and some others went off on a junket to Europe to study European central banks. And then Aldrich and Paul Warburg and Vanderlip and a number of other Rockefeller and Morgan people went down to Jekyll Island in Georgia, and they met secretly and devised what was essentially the foundational piece of paper for the Federal Reserve Act, 1913. eventually became something called the Aldrich Bill, but the basic structure was devised there. It's interesting. People can still go down there. It's now a Marriott Hotel. It was then a private club. It's now a Marriott Hotel, and they have retained that portion, which was there in 1911. And, in fact, they have the room where you can go in. There's even a plaque on the door. It says Federal Reserve Room. You can go in, and there are pictures of the conspirators right there on one of the walls. And you can sit in the place where this whole thing was hatched.
Yeah, you tell about all this in Crashmaker.
Oh, yeah, it's there. You can go down and see it. And I've been there on a number of occasions. Fascinating to be. You can almost feel the ghosts of these people in the woodwork. But in any event, they did that. And they passed the Federal Reserve Act on the basis that it would give a more elastic currency than the National Bank Act. National Bank Act was limited to government debt. The Federal Reserve Act opened that up and said, well, essentially any good asset can be monetized. So the farmers went along with that because they thought it would help them in harvest periods when they needed credit. The manufacturers went along with it. The people who wanted to buy government debt. Everyone who wanted to get into this act essentially had some kind of iron in the fire.
All right, Edwin, we got a break. Stay tuned. This is a very interesting program.
Have you heard of a privacy crisis? Odds are you're already immersed in one. The U.S. government is now legally tapping phones, monitoring emails, tracking purchases, and seizing property in record numbers. Banks are demanding invasive personal information for even the smallest transaction. Unfortunately, stalkers looking to harm you or your financial situation are using the same methods. So how can you protect yourself, your loved ones, and all that you own? Well, the first step is to purchase the most important how-to book you'll ever read. It's called Privacy Crisis by author Grant Hall. In minutes, you'll know the methods he himself has used and advised others about in order to bank anonymously, open a safety deposit box without a social security number. With Privacy Crisis, you'll discover how to avoid judgments, seal your credit files airtight, drop off the radar, and virtually disappear from those looking to cause you injury. The ebook and hardcover versions are available at www.privacycrisis.com. Grant Hall's Privacy Crisis contains information and legal methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously. Live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
Take the heat out of your sleep. The Bedfan Personal Cooling System will work for anyone that is a hot sleeper, regardless of the reason. It gives you a deep, restful sleep, the way nature intended. No more tossing and turning. Say goodbye to sleepless nights. So ask yourself, are you a hot sleeper and really want to sleep cooler? A woman who suffers from the effects of menopause, including night sweats derived from hot flashes, have a medical condition that causes your body to get hot at night, or just want to save money on your air conditioning bill. It works instantly. No tools or assembly required. Don't worry. The Bedfan fits short beds, tall beds, beds with footboards, sleigh beds, water beds, and many other types of beds. If you want great relief and total comfort, give us a call at 1-210-632-8280. That's 1-210-632-8280. Or visit our site at bedfan.com. Your provider for great sleep.
Pinch me, Bill. I can't believe it. A few months ago, I couldn't even afford gas for my car. And here we are with season tickets on the 50-yard line.
I know what you mean, John. I remember the day you saw my new car and asked me if I robbed Bill Gates. Our lives sure have changed since we discovered DidYouRobBillGates.com.
I was struggling to make ends meet. Now I've got a new car. And a college fund for Lisa when she graduates from high school next year. And I owe it all to you. Because you told me about DidYouRobBillGates.com.
Hey, John, we all win when the money problems disappear. I want to tell everybody. Because the more people we have on the success team, the better it works. It's hard for the little guy these days. We pool our resources to level the playing field.
So the more people that go to www.DidYouRobBillGates.com, the more cash for everybody. What a concept.
Back with the Live Free Zone program, Tommy Crier's program. I'm the substitute host today, Larry B. Kraft. My guest is Edwin Vieira. Edwin, before the break, we were at the stage of the panic of 1907, and the system that we had, you know, today's system would have been in place back then. We had the conspirators plotting to replace the We had state banks and we had national banks that were issuing currency back in that day. And now they're going to come forward with a proposal to have a national central bank that's going to issue Federal Reserve notes.
Right, well, actually, we didn't have any state banks issuing currency because there was a law that taxed them. There was a 10% tax.
Yes, you're right.
So they drove the state notes out of – see, centralization. We're always talking about centralization here. You had a lot of state banks pre-Civil War. Post-Civil War, they create the National Currency Act, which is the first attempt to centralize, and they tax the state bank notes out of existence. National Currency Act couldn't work because it was limited by the amount of government debt that the banks could get, and obviously that depended on how much the government would generate. So they didn't have what they considered to be a sufficiently elastic currency, at least elastic in the sense of expanding. They could contract it pretty easily, but they couldn't expand it very well. So that was the first argument. We need an elastic currency that can expand. Their second argument was we need a lender of last resort. We need to be able to bail out banks that go into crisis, the ones that overexpand themselves personally through the fractional reserve system. And they didn't really have a good system for doing that under the National Currency Act. And thirdly, we want to give people some sense of stability here. So they put in a 40% gold reserve requirement for this new currency, this Federal Reserve note currency, which we still have today. Now, you look at that on paper, leaving the elasticity question aside, you say, well, 40% reserve, that's a pretty good amount, one would think. Wrong. Right? Because along comes 1929, 1932, and we discover that 40% was clearly not sufficient. And so what do? Did they learn the lesson? Under Roosevelt, the banking crisis of 1932,
they... HR 192.
Yeah, what they did was exactly the opposite. They said, oh, no, we're not going to pay out any gold. And besides that, we're going to call in all the gold that the American people hold themselves and use that to try and stabilize this system internationally because they maintained international payments of gold during that period. So instead of correcting the problem, they made it worse. They made the relationship between the bankers and the politicians even tighter than it had been in the past. And we have maintained that, as they used to call it, suspension of specie payments, failure of the banks to pay their debts on their currency, since 1933. It's still with us. Federal Reserve doesn't pay out gold or silver in redemption of its currency, and neither does the Treasury. Now, what's interesting is that although gold was removed from the system in the 1930s, 33 and 34, silver remained in the system.
Oh, the constitutional currency.
Constitutional currency. It's fascinating. These guys didn't even understand enough about the Constitution to know what to do to ruin it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But along comes Kennedy. Kennedy took the first step, which was the depreciation of the silver currency by debasement. And so we went to eventually to the what called the Kennedy half dollars, the Eisenhower dollar coin and so forth, which were 40% silver. And then eventually under Johnson, silver was removed entirely.
Edwards, we got our top of the hour break. Folks, stay tuned to this fascinating program.
It's true.